Today's lecture is going to be longer because the tutorial session will be just 10 minutes. And so during the tutorial session, it's mainly to get clarifications on the last problem set, which is very close to the problem set you already had, but I just fixed some typos and I added a couple of problems. And maybe Beata can start sharing the one without solutions. Now, not all the problems are supposed to be solved, you know, in 1 hour or two. It's something that can stay with you for a while. It will be very instructive for you to try and learn these techniques. And in a couple of days, I will have the worked out solutions be sent to everyone so that you can check or find out how to solve these problems if you couldn't. So without further ado, let's start. And let's see, let me do a small summary of what we have learned. Okay. So basically, so far we have learned a couple of things. First of all, we have learned some notions of quantum mechanics. Well, let me say quantum informations, because these are techniques that are used a lot in the community of quantum information, and it is to see states as operators. Can you see my screen? Okay. Hold on a sec. Okay, thank you, Beata, for sharing. Great. Okay, so if I only could see now the people again. Okay, I cannot see the. There you go. All right. Okay, so states are operators. And then we start learning some typically quantum information tools, like the role that entropy plays. And we will see a lot more about this today, why it's so important. And our main problem is the problem of equilibration, which is, how is equilibration possible in the face of having unitary evolution? So we have seen definitely that this cannot happen. And what we want to show is something like this, that there are conditions that we need to understand still what they are, such that when we look at A of T, which is the expectation value of some observable in psi of T, then A of T takes typical values that we call A bar. And so the typical value, say, bar is the trace of A in phi bar. And phi bar is obtained by the initial state phi by defacing in the basis of the Hamiltonian. So if the Hamiltonian can be written in its spectral resolution like this, then you just deface, means doing this thing, for 5 bar. And this will give you, as you know, the populations, the initial populations, times these projectors. Okay? So, saying that typically it will have this value, it means that the probability of A of T being different from A bar, more than a certain epsilon, is very small. Okay, so this is what we want to show, that this is possible. And in order to get to this result, we have started, you know, playing with some interesting results like time average and hour average. Okay, so time averaging is this operation, right? That we know it becomes this, right? It's the defacing. We know it's not unitary, we discussed that. And then hour averaging, which is whatever function you have that depends on the state, you average over all the possible states in the Hilbert space. Okay, and we found some results. The results that we found is, first of all, if you consider the Loschmidt echo, which is the return probability, so it is this thing, and you time average it, this is just the purity of the defaced state. So this shows that the purity of the defaced state is which if I want to write in terms of the populations is this. So this is another way of seeing that the defacing is not unitary because it changes the purity. But then we can do more, and this is the last thing that we did, was to say, okay, so as you can see, this quantity that we just wrote, this quantity, depends explicitly on phi, right? Because it's there. So it would be interesting to know, okay, so now this is a function of phi, right? Let me say it explicitly, it's a function of phi. What is on average in the Hilbert space, this quantity like? So we do this hard averaging, we try it on all the possible states and we average. And we found that this result using the techniques that we have learned, 2/d+1. So this is just the average. So we are saying that on average, the purity of the defaced state is very small. Right? And now I have a question for you. As we had time to comment, knowing the average of something does not mean much. This is the average, right? So imagine you have a bimodal distribution. So you have a population that has, you know, you have values that are +1 and -1, and the average is 0. However, you never observe 0, right? So the average, it's a value that is never observed. Or even if the expectation value does, you know, is the most observed outcome if the distribution of your values is very, very squat? Well, then it's not really that you can expect to be here. What it really means is that you expect your values to fall in a very large interval, right? So finding that the average is such does not mean that this is the typical case. You know, physics makes sense because you find that some averages that you find, like when you make a measurement, they are also typical. Typical means the error is small. If the error is large, it's not typical, then, you know, you cannot conclude anything. You don't have any information. And so my question for you is, do you think by just looking at this, that this is typical, or it might have large fluctuations?
Can you repeat the question, please?
I would like to understand. So this is an average, right? You see, this is the average over phi. And I want to know the variance of this quantity. The variance of this quantity. I want to know if it's small or large. And the hint that we have, that we are interested in a system that has high dimensionality. Why? Because imagine you have a system of spins 1/2. So it is C2 tensor N, remember. The dimensionality of this guy is equal to 2 to the N. So this is D. So you see it's exponentially large in the number of qubits. So even if you have just 30 qubits, it's a huge number. Of course, we cannot expect that things like thermodynamics, typicality, and all the things have any value for just a few qubits, right? So we are in the term, you know, we are thinking of N large, but even when N is not very large, D is huge because it's exponential. So this is the thing that you have to keep in mind, that this is a large, D is a large number. So with this premise, what we can say about this object? Any idea? An intuition about this. So let me give you a hint. Is this is our random variable, right? Is L bar is our random variable that we have, that depends on phi, and we are averaging over the ensemble phi. Is this random variable positive definite or not? Or it can be negative?
It's always positive.
Yeah, it's always greater or equal than zero, right? And its average is very small. So if I plot this, if this is my ensemble of phis, and this is my quantity that depends on phi, so the average is very small, right? So it's very close to zero, because it's 1 over D, as you can see. But this cannot be negative, right? So look how much it can fluctuate. So if you have, so this is a very important thing in statistics or in probability theory, that if you have a quantity that is non-negative and it has a small average, then it's also typical. it also has a small variance. This is called Markov inequality. And you use it because it's just a consequence of the Chebyshev inequality, which is the foundation of physics, because it's the tool that connects experiments to the theory. Without the Chebyshev inequality, experiments would not tell us anything about the confirmation of a theory. And Markov inequality says that if x is greater or equal than zero, then the probability of x greater than a certain value of a is upper bounded by the expectation value of x over a. So you see that this Loschmidt echo is actually typically very small in the Hilbert space. The probability of being greater than a number a is 1 over dA, is upper bounded by 1 over dA. So you can make A very, very, very small. You know, you can make A equal 1 over square root of D, which is very small, right? Because D is an exponentially small number. And this means that the probability of X being larger than 1 over square root of D is upper bounded by 1 over square root of D. So you see, at the same time, we're saying that we are very close to the average with almost one probability. Very good. Now, the next step is the following. We are very interested in knowing what is the, so we have seen that the values of the Loschmidt echo are typical and they're very small. Now I'm asking you another question, and it is the following. Imagine that I have, it's about entanglement. So I have my system divided in two parts, and I take a psi, a pure state in H. So this is pure, right? But it might be entangled or it might be not entangled. And if it is entangled, then the trace of psi A square is smaller than one if psi is entangled. And indeed, we know that we can measure the entropy, for example, the Tourani entropy in this way. And now my question would be, what is this? How entangled is on average a state in the Hilbert space? Are they weakly entangled? Are they very entangled? Are product states very rare? Is the average entanglement what? Okay, so this is a very interesting question that it per se is a very interesting question. How typical is entanglement in the Hilbert space? But we will use it as a result to show equilibration, okay? And how do we proceed in this way? We say, oh, look, this quantity, because of minus log is a convex function, then this is greater than minus log of the average of trace of psi A squared. And now this is an object that we know how to compute. Why? Because we know that we can write this thing as the average of the trace of psi A tensor 2 times the swap operator on two copies of A. And now everything is linear, so this is minus log the trace of TA2. And now you have the average of psi A tensor 2.
Yasha, we cannot see the screen anymore. You're on Zoom, I think. Like your Zoom. Yeah. Thank you.
And now you know how to compute that. So this is one of the problems. And the solution is, because let's discuss the result, is this.
Sorry, you're once again.
I have minus log of this.
Sorry, you're once again off the bottom of the screen, though.
Sorry, man.
Okay. Yeah. And then one other thing is, the left-hand side, is that S2, or should that be the average of S2 with respect to phi? Oops,
yeah,
I, sorry.
This is the average with respect to, I forgot to put it here. Okay. So let me just write the purity. So let me write the purity.
Sorry, Alyosha?
Yeah?
Could I ask you to go back to the previous page for just a second? Because we couldn't see it for most of the time. Thanks.
Can you see it clear like this?
Yeah, sorry. It's just we didn't have very long to look at it because it wasn't...
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
No problem. Can I move to the next page, guys?
Okay. Thank you.
So let me just call the purity trace of psi A square. Of course, remember A, we need to trace out to B, otherwise it's a silly thing to do. We know psi is pure. We want to know the purity of the subsystem. And we are averaging this over all the psi's. This is the exercise. And we are saying that this is equal to dA plus dB over the ADB plus one. And the situation that is interesting for us, so this is an exact result. There is no approximation here. But the situation that is interesting is the following. Imagine this is the Hilbert space, and this is A, and this is B. And we want the dimension of B being much greater than the dimension of A. So A is where we are making our measurements. So A must be much smaller than the rest of the world because measurements are local. That's another fact of nature. You cannot look at everything at the same time. In fact, it's one of the most important facts of nature, or at the very least of the way man interface with nature. Now, dB is much greater than dA, but also dA as a subsystem should be quite large, should still contain many particles so that we can do statistics. Okay, so this is the typical thermodynamic situation that also in classical statistical mechanics, you typically do, okay? You're saying, oh, the number of particles in my subsystem must be very large, but it's much smaller than the bath. I'm not calling B the bath though, because I'm not saying that B has thermalized, right? So I'm not using tortoises here. We have a pure state psi that is a pure state on the joint Hilbert space of A and B together. It's pure. And we're looking at it locally on A because that's what us as human being can do. So you see that if dB is much greater than the A, much greater than one, then the above expression, so, okay, of course, dA, dB, I can neglect this. And I can neglect the A with respect to the B. So I have the B over the A, the B, which is 1 over the A. And because the A is 2 to the number of particles, of spins, of qubits that I have in A, this is very small. And minus the log of this, so S2, is greater on average than log 2 of the A. But this is the upper bound to entanglement, because this is also smaller or equal than log 2 of the A. And therefore, it's typical. So what we are saying is that with very high probability, one way to see that this is very high probability, the purity is also positive definite. And it's a very small number. Again, for the Markov inequality, it must be typical in this value. It's exactly the same reasoning as before. So the result is almost all states are maximally entangled. Which is quite interesting. Okay. Now, we are almost ready to discuss equilibration. In order to discuss equilibration, I have to give you another tool, which is very important in quantum information. This is a very quantum information-y tool. And it is the notion of distance between states. And this is a very operationally defined distance. Okay, so let me define it. I have the distance between two states and rho and sigma. So remember that states are not a thing. States are part of the theoretical nucleus by which we compute expectation values that are the things that we observe. So imagine that I make a projective measurement P. P is a project, rank, let's say rank one projector, right? Something like this. Okay, so these are our measurements. You know that every observable can be expanded in terms of rank one projectors. It's the spectral resolution. And I could look at the expectation value of P in rho and compare it to the expectation value of P in sigma. Let me take also the absolute value of this difference. So if these two values are different, then the states are different, right? But if these two values are the same, when I measure P, does it mean that the two states are the same? The answer is no. Why is that? So imagine that you want to distinguish Beata from me. And the measurement that you make is to count the number of limbs. Well, this will not tell Beata and me apart because we both have four limbs. That's not a very telling measurement to distinguish Beata from me. However, maybe if you use the length of hair, maybe you will. So the distance between two states is the most telling of all the possible measurements. This is our definition. It's the max over the piece. Okay, so you see, it's operationally defined what we mean by distance between states. And this has all the properties of a distance. And theorem, this is equal to 1/2 of the norm 1, remember our norms, of rho minus sigma, which by putting the definition of norm 1, this is 1/2 the trace of rho minus sigma dagger rho minus sigma. Okay, so this distance between states. So we need a notional distance because when we talk about equilibration, is some notion of convergence. So that's why we need a topology, means we need a distance. And what do we do with this? So this distance has some very interesting. So first of all, it has all the properties of the distance, triangular inequality, positive, semi-positive definite, and so on. But then as this property, consider a map phi that is trace preserving. In particular, without there is a bit also generality, but so you actually, it's very general, this property, you just need the trace preserving. But let's say that this map is any map that maps states into states. So it's, for instance, U is such a map, right? Because you take a state phi and you get phi t, which is still a state. This one, is this a map or not? Is this a trace preserving map or not? Is it mapping states into states or not? Yes. What about the partial trace? This is the map that takes phi and associates phi A. This is also a map that takes states and associates to it states, right? This is again an Hermitian positive operator with trace one. What about the measurement, which is the map that takes phi and gives us, when we're measuring some operator that is expanded in a basis of a projectors Pn, gives us the sum over n Pn Pn. Remember, this is what happens after a measurement. Is this a state or not? Yes. Okay. So you see, all the things that you can do in quantum mechanics are maps that are trace preserving, and they're a bit more than trace preserving. They also preserve the positivity of your operation. So then in layman words, they send states into states. Okay. So for these maps, there is a beautiful theorem that says, imagine that have two states, rho and sigma, and they have some distance d. And now I do something on the states. So this is phi rho, and then I do the same thing to sigma. And I want to compare the new distance between the two states after I did something. I made some measurements, or I evolved them in time, or I trace out something, or I deface them, you name it. Whatever you do in quantum mechanics, You cannot increase the distance. And this is a very profound statement. Anything you do will decrease the distance between two states. Corollary, the distance between two marginal states, so I trace out something, is smaller than the distance between the two states. Let's go back to the example of the state of Beata and the state of myself. We are orthogonal because we can be perfectly distinguishable. So we have distance one, we are orthogonal states. However, if you trace out everything but the number of limbs, we may be indistinguishable. Our distance has decreased. You see? Okay, very good. A very important lemma that we're gonna use is the following, that the trace distance, well, allow me not to put the one off to read this thing. Okay, so the norm one of the difference between rho and sigma is smaller than the square root of the dimension of the space times the norm two of this difference, which is, if you remember the definition, the square root of d times the trace over rho minus sigma square. And this is very useful because this is the type of objects, the trace of squares, that we learned how to deal with using the swap operator. So this is the guy that has operational meaning. This is the stuff that we know how to compute. So that's why this lemma is very important.
Sorry, Alyosha, once again, I have to ask you to just scroll down a little bit, please. Thank you.
Thank you for reminding me. Okay. So now let's prove, or at least sketch the proof of a bunch of theorems. Okay, now we have all the tools. Now let's play. Okay. And so equilibration. Consider the following object, okay? So first of all, let me call omega my defaced state. Okay, remember it's phi bar. And of course, omega s is the restriction of this state when I trace up, in the following s is what I called a before. And please allow me to change the notation because s is the system and b is the rest, is the bar. Okay, so omega s is our subsystem, is where we actually do the experiments. So whatever experiment you make will be some operator that has support on HS. So our Hilbert space has this form. And so you will use these states to do measurements, states on S. So what was our premise? We were trying to say that, remember that A at the time T must be similar to A bar. Remember what it was at the time T, it was trace of A in phi T. And this should be similar to the trace of A, the same operator, in phi bar, which is omega. But now, because A has to support only on S, right? It's our local measurement. What we really want to say, I mean, it's an identity, is that the trace of A in phi S at the time T is similar to the expectation value of A in omega S. So this is what we want to say. Right? This is equilibration. Remember? We want to say that they're very close, these two values, on average. When we average over time. And again, if this distance is very small and the distance is a positive number, then it's also typical. Do you agree this is what we really want? This is what we want. This is equilibration. If we can prove this.
Is that an average bar over each of those quantities?
Yes. Although this does not depend on the bar, on time.
I was about to ask that, yeah.
But I can still put it because it doesn't depend on time. Right? I can still average over time, even if it doesn't depend on time. It means that it's identical itself.
Yeah.
Okay. So in other words, you see, I'm saying that for every A that I can look at, this should be the case. So what I'm really saying is that I want the distance between phi ST and omega S on average to be small. So if I show you this, then I have equilibration. I'm saying on average, on time, I can't distinguish by experiments on S the state, the real state, from the one that is the canonical state. Well, then that's it. It has equilibrated. Is this is the mathematical statement of this plot, that you have A of T, this is A bar, and you have a transient, and then if I average over all time, over a very long time, then this doesn't count, right? Over infinite time. And on this interval, I can't really distinguish it because the distance, the average distance is small. So, of course, a picture is worth 1,000 words, but you cannot prove anything with pictures. And this is the precise statement, the one that, you know, as a quantum physicist, we should be able to prove. Okay, let's do that. And it's 10:45, so I cannot do all the details, but I will have to put them in the note so that you can see that. So first of all, let me tell you what is the result. Okay, theorem. The distance between phi of s at the time t and omega s, which is the dephased state, average over time is upper bounded by 1/2 ds square, the trace of omega square. The purity of the dephased state. There you go. That's where we use it. And so now let's interpret this result. If our defaced state has not a very low purity, right, it could happen, then this number is a large number, and this distance, we are not saying is small, then we do not have equilibration. But typically, what is the trace of omega squared? Typically, almost always, we just said that. Well, we will be able to prove something. This is the okay, by doing a proof very similar to the one that is in the problems, you can show that this goes like 1 over d, not 1 over ds. See, this is the full state. So this means that typically, this distance is upper bounded by 1 half d square s over d. But d is ds db, right? Because our Hilbert space is HS tensor HP. And therefore, you have this, so this cancels. So you see that typically the average distance between a state and the wannabe equilibrium state is upper bounded by the square root of ds over db. But now remember that we are in this situation, which NB is much larger than NA, and DB is 2 to the NB, and DS is 2 to the NA, so this, and because of this, this is a super large number, so this is DB over DS. Super large. And therefore, in the bound here, I have ds over db. So maybe I should rewrite it in this other way. Okay, so ds over db is equal to ns minus nb, which is super small.
Alyosha, I have one question.
Yeah.
On the previous page, when you said that the trace of omega squared is typically 1 over d, is a more precise way of saying that the Haar average is 1 over d?
Yeah. When I say typically, I mean...
You mean the Haar average.
Haar average. And okay. Remember that by omega, I mean the h phi.
Yeah.
So you first have to deface it. So how do we prove this? Let's say I want to prove this. Well, what I do is that, okay, I want the trace of omega squared. I want to average it on phi. So this is the average on phi of the trace of dh phi, right? Square. Okay, we have the usual problem. I cannot bring the average inside because I have a square. Well, let's use our trick, which is, this is the trace of dh phi tensor 2 times t2. But now now everything is linear. So this is going to be equal to the trace of the H tensor 2, phi tensor 2 averaged. And now you know to plug it in here. We know. So once you have that one result from group theory, you use it, T2. And then you find this is equal to 1 over T. So compute. So this is one of the exercises to do. However, this one theorem here, so you see this is before the hard average. Here there is no hard averaging. This is just the time averaging. This is more complicated. And because it's already 10:52, and I want to say many other things, let me skip for the moment. And then maybe we go back to it. Okay, so let me sketch again what is the strategy of all the things. Let me make a summary of all the things that we have learned. Okay, so let me see if I can fit everything in this one slide. So we have our Hilbert space is HS tensor HB. And we have states that if I average them in time, they become the H phi, and I call them omega. Okay. Good. And we have proven the following statements, or actually we claimed we prove these statements. The first one is that if I take, so I'm interested in states that are observed locally because that's where I make my measurements. So I take my state phi, I evolve it in time. And then I look at it, which means phi st, which is the trace over B of phi t, right? And I'm saying phi s of t is very similar to omega when I look at s. So that this distance should be small on average in time. And I claimed, I didn't prove it, but I claimed that this is smaller or equal than 1 half the S square trace of omega square. Okay, so this distance could be large or small. So let's try it on many different states. So I want to take this distance. And I want to know typically for phi what it is. And you see that it's going to be also upper bounded by this value. I can bring the average under the square root because square root is a concave function. So I get the inequality in the right way.
You're going to give us a proof of that theorem later?
Yeah, I'll try. So let me go ahead with the discourse and then I will try, time permitting, I will try to give you the proof.
Yeah, at least in a
I will try to sketch it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So this is a theorem that I didn't prove. I'm just claiming. But now, in order, you know, to you know, we know. So this is another. This is an exercise. It's the exercise that I just sketched above. Or what is the typical purity of the defaced state? And I'm claiming this is 1 over D. But you do that as an exercise. And let me see if there is something else that I really want to say. Ah, okay. So, you see, we are saying that because of this result, typically, phi s of t is very close to omega s. So let me write it in a more sloppy but clearer. Almost always. Notation. We know what we mean now. Is in all this sense of first the time average and then the hard average. But we still have a mystery, which is who is this? Who is this state that is our equilibrium state? Yeah, we know that this is equal to dH phi. But that's a bit unsatisfying because it still depends on the initial state very much. Although we are trying to average on phi. So we need a new theorem.
But isn't omega s the partial trace of the omega without the s?
Come again, please.
That you just said that that omega s is the defacing of.
So it is the partial trace, as you said.
Uh-huh.
Of this.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, is what I'm saying.
And. But I want to say. I want to understand what this looks like typically. Because you see, this depends on phi, but this is, what is it typically? So what I want to say is, if I take, I have a candidate that is some canonical state, let me call it canonical. And the other theorem I want to make is that this distance of so remember omega s, let me write it again, omega s is the trace over b dh phi. So this depends on phi. So this distance depends on phi. But I want to say it's almost always very small. So what I will do, I will say that this distance, on average, I want to say it's small. For the right canonical state. And what is the right canonical state for which this theorem is true? Is the microcanonical ensemble. So you see what I'm saying is that if I take a state, I deface it, and I look at it locally, almost always looks like the microcanonical state. And so we have quantum thermodynamics. So we have all not only said that I've equilibrated to a state so that my values are typical, but those typical values are those of the microcanonical state. Okay, so this is the theorem I would like to. So actually, because I have already written up all the notes for this one, you can try to do this one as an exercise and then look it up in the notes how to do it. Whereas maybe right now with the time that we have, I can try to prove you this theorem here. Let's do like that, okay? Okay, so theorem the distance between phi s at the time t and omega s averaging over time is upper bounded by 1/2 the square root of d square s trace of omega square, where omega is dh phi. Okay? Proof. So, I mean, I did put this as an exercise to do, but yeah, I know, no, this is not really something that one can do as an exercise. It's kind of hard. So, of course, it's not hard after you have done it, but so let's do it. Okay. So, we use this lemma that I sketched before, that the distance between rho sigma is 1/2 the trace of rho minus sigma dagger times rho minus sigma, but these are Hermitian things, so it's rho minus sigma square. And this is upper bounded by 1/2. Okay, now I have a very bad notation because d is both the symbol for distance and the dimension of the Hilbert space, so let me call the distance capital D, okay? And so we have, okay, this doesn't fit. So it's smaller or equal than 1/2 the trace of, sorry, the square root of D times the trace of rho minus sigma square. Okay, so we use this. So this is an identity, it's a lemma that we're gonna use. Okay, so our object of interest is this one. Okay. And now because the square root is concave as a function, if I bring an average under the square root, I get an upper bound. So I will have the distance between, okay, so here I will have ds, okay. So this is for rho and sigma that are on a space of dimension d. Now, these are my rho and sigma. So what is the dimension of the space is gonna be ds, right? And now, oh, I forgot the 1/2. And now I have the average of the trace of rho minus sigma, what are rho and sigma is phi st minus omega s, and this is squared. Okay? So, do you understand why using this lemma for this quantity we get this? And I could bring the average under the square root because the square root is concave, so I get an upper bound. Okay. Now, what is phi s t minus omega s? What is it? Well, it is the trace over b of is this, right? It's the trace over B of phi t minus omega. So let me write it. So phi s t minus omega s is, let me use the trace over B at the end, okay? So right now pretend this is just phi t minus omega. Then I will trace out B. So this is gonna be the sum. Okay, so let me, do you agree that this is do you agree that this is phi t? It's phi t, right? What is omega s? It's the defaced state. Sorry, what is omega? It's the defaced state. So it's the diagonal elements. Okay, so the difference between the two is just this. And now I'm tracing over B, right? I have to trace over B because I have to look at it on S. But the trace over B only acts on this, right? Because these are just before these are just numbers, so I can put it there. Oh, the beauties of linear algebra. Okay. So now let's take, now that we know what is this object, let's take the square of it. And the trace, and then average over time. This is the object that is inside here, you see? Okay. So let's do that. So let me first take the square, which means that I have the sum over k different from L, and then m different from n. And now I have the square of this object, right? Which will contain the indexes k, L, m, n. Let me call it calligraphic t, k, L, m, n. And, oh, by the way, this trace, on what space is happening? You have to tell me. I'm not going ahead if you don't tell me. If I don't say where the trace is going, it means it's on the total space of those operators, which is in this case is what? These operators live in what space?
The bath.
Say again, please.
The bath. I just said these are
omega S is an operator on HS, right?
Oh, so even though it's the total space which is still H sub S.
Yes, so this is S.
Right.
Very good. Okay, so let me write it. So then I have the trace of S on S. And now I have this object, the trace over B times the trace over B of the EKL with the new indexes, right? So this is trace over B, EKEL times trace over B, EM, EN. oh, I forgot the bar, I have to average over time. Of all these objects, where is the only term that is time dependent?
In the T?
It's this one, right? So it's in the T, yes. Okay, very good. So let me write explicitly what is this calligraphic T. I mean, it's boring because I just need to write this term twice, right? So let me do this very boring thing.
The trace over S is on the both traces of B, right?
So I have this product.
Okay.
And then I take the trace over S.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So you agree that this is calligraphic T? And when I average over time, means that I'm actually averaging over time this one. Let me take a new page. Now, remember that in this expression, K is already different from L, and M is already different from N. And remember that we have this hypothesis that we said a couple of days ago, which is like a long time ago, that we have non-degenerate gaps, which means that if AK minus EL is equal to EM minus EN, then EK must be equal to EM and EL must be equal to EN. This means that when you take that average, you will get, so the result of that average will be, so e to the minus I, all the thing, t, will be equal to delta kn delta lm. And in fact, here, I made a mistake. It's the other way around. Kn lm. Because here we have actually, in that expression, we have a minus in front here. That's why. So all the time average does is to put these deltas there. So if you plug them in, you are left with, so what was the object that we were looking at? It was the trace of phi s t minus omega s square and then averaged. And this is going to be equal to the sum over k and l that are different of ck square. This is what happens after you plug the deltas in, times the trace over s of the trace over b of ek EL times the trace over B of EL EK. Now, okay, so now this term requires some linear algebra manipulation. That I will put in the notes, but you can try to do as an exercise and show that this is actually going to be equal to the, this term, let me write it here, is gonna to be equal to the trace over B of the trace over S PK times the trace over S PL. And I have to put actually here these coefficients. So that the whole thing can be written as so doing some manipulation, you can exchange, you can swap, you see, here we have first the trace over B and then the trace over S. Playing a little bit around with that, you can first take the trace over S and then trace over B. By PK, of course, I mean KK, and PL, I mean LL. Okay. Actually, it's not too difficult of a manipulation, but you can get there. Okay, now you see here with the sum of these objects over K and L as long as they are different. Now I could add the terms K equal L and then subtract them. Which is this very silly and incredibly powerful thing that we do every time we do analysis, right? We add and subtract the same thing. So if we add it, okay, now, so if you have the sum over all the k's and all the l's, well, you remember that the sum over CK square PK is omega. What is this? Right? These are the populations and these are the projectors. And in this expression, this not omega because it's not the sum over all the k's or over all the l's, but now it's the sum. When I add this term, I have the sum over all the k's and all the l's. So this is gonna be omega and this is gonna be omega. So here I get, let me erase this. We get equal to the trace over B of omega square B, because I've traced out S, minus, now I have to subtract the term where K is equal to L. Trace over S and trace over B PK square. Oh, but look, this is a state squared, and this is the trace of a state square. It's a state in the abstract sense because it's a mathematical state. So this is upper bounded by one. Okay, but it's positive anyway. So this is a positive number. So this is upper bounded by just the trace over B, omega square B. Okay, now we use one more inequality that is upper bounded by the purity of the full state times the dimension of whatever is left from B. Because at most it's pure on S. Very good. All right. So now we're ready. So remember, so this object is upper bounding this one. So now let's plug everything together. So we go back to this thing. To this thing that contained this object here that is upper bounding the way we just showed. So let's plug everything together. And so we have that the distance between phi st and omega s averaged on time is upper bounded by 1/2 the square root of ds square trace of omega square. Which is the desired result. Okay. So we are done. So I can summarize in one slide all the things we have done. Okay. First of all, we have understood that phi evolves in time, but I am forced to look at it locally because that's how our measurements go. And that the distance between this state and the state omega s, which is the local state of the defaced state of the time average, if I look at it at all times, is upper bounded by what I just said. Okay, 1/2 square root d square s trace omega square, which means that I have small temporal fluctuations if the defaced space, the defaced state is not pure at all. So if this is small. Okay, so it's worthwhile to understand whether this is small in general. And we showed that this is upper bounded by 2 over d. I forgot the 2 before. Anyway, it goes like 1 over d. So it is true that this thing will happens almost always. So equilibration is not a mystery. Second result, who is omega s? Typically, omega s is the canonical state almost always. So almost always, you get to equilibrium, and almost always the equilibrium values are those of the macroeconomical ensemble.
Sorry, Alyosha, to interrupt you very quickly, that IS, is that the identity?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
The identity on S.
Yes.
Identity operator on HS. Okay, so this concludes this, you know, to the force in the foundations of quantum statistical mechanics using quantum information. It leaves many it's not everything is solved. It leaves many problems open. And so first of all, right now we only found the microcanonical ensemble. We didn't find the canonical ensemble, which is the Gibbs state. So we didn't find the temperature right now. This can be done with additional assumptions. The other, and there are other two hypotheses here that we have used that are difficult to justify, and they're not independent between, you know, they're not the same, but they're interconnected. One is, in order to prove disequilibration and thermalization results, I had to look at infinite time, at a very, very large time. But thermalization is something that happens in short times. That's why we know it's there. So, but this approach doesn't let you extract the time scales. So if you want to know the time scale of equilibration and thermalization, we feel we need to know in order to say, oh, we have understood what's going on. Then you cannot extract them from this approach. That's the first critique to this approach. The second critique is something that one of you wrote to me about yesterday and said, why the hard average? The hard average is the statement that every state in the Hilbert space is equally likely in nature. And justifying this hypothesis is very hard. In fact, there are arguments against that. And this is, you know, this is material for a much longer and profound discussion. But so let me leave it at that. This very strong assumption that every state in a Hilbert space, that Hilbert space is so democratic, actually that nature is so democratic when it comes to the Hilbert space. This is a very strong hypothesis that it's hard to justify. It is kind of connected to the infinite time thing, because one way of justifying it is ergodicity. Says, hey, if I wait forever, I will explore all the states with an equally likely probability, which is the statement of ergodicity, and there you go. So ergodicity is already a problematic statement, but again, you require infinite time. And we don't have infinite time to see thermalization. So we need something that explains thermalization in finite time. And, you know, that so people have obtained the result for thermalization at infinite times, starting from this kind of techniques. And this is not a completely closed subject yet. Actually, people do research in these things. I do. So, but you have touched the one solution to the problem of quantum equilibration and quantum thermalization, because not only before it was thought to be impossible, right? Because evolution is unitary. Now you not only know that it's possible, but it happens almost always. And well, that's true.
When it doesn't happen?
Well, yeah, so this is the complete understanding on the necessary conditions for not happening is not something that we know. But of course, there are sufficient conditions. One condition is that your initial state, so you don't pick your initial state randomly, but you prepare your initial state in a way that it is not a large superposition of the energy eigenstates, but it is a small superposition of the energy eigenstates. So you prepare your state in a superposition of just the two states of your Hamiltonian. If your system is small enough, maybe you can do that in the lab. It's not very easy. That's why usually we do observe equilibration. But it is possible. So if you do that, then your system will oscillate between those two states. And therefore, the expectation varies will oscillate with the cosine between those two, also our sine, between those two states. And you don't have thermalization. That is one possibility. It's not the only possibility. The other possibility is that your Hamiltonian is not ergodic, which means that you really need to observe on infinite time to see it happening. But that goes back to the comment that I already made. And there are a few more possibilities here. Or if the observable that you're looking at is very non-local, then also you will not see thermalization. But non-local observables are hard to observe.
Thank you, Aloysia.
You're very welcome. So I think this is all. And we can go to the break rooms. And in the break rooms, so it will not be a long session. It will be just, we will go over the text of the problems that Beate and I can make sure that you know what they're asking you to do. And so you can have fun on your own or in small groups trying to prove these things. And in a couple of days, because I want you to try for a couple of days, I will send you a file with all the solutions so you have all the proofs. Okay, see you in the break rooms then.
So Ayesha, as we are already over time, I was thinking that maybe we should not do the break rooms today. And if you want to go over the problem set, maybe you can just do it all together. Like in this group.
Great, let's go over. So that's a great idea, Beata, thank you. So yeah, let's do it all overall. Let's do it all together. So do you have questions? You have the file.
Probably my only question. Go ahead, Diana.
No, you go first.
Go ahead, Diana, please.
Okay, that in the general canonical state, we have to use the definition of the Haar average, but also I don't see very clearly right now where the pi 2 times is coming from, because the Haar average is an integral, right?
So the Haar average is an integral, and it's an integral over the full space. And because everything is linear, because integrals are linear, so if you want to know what is the Haar average in a subspace, what you do is that you take the average and you project it onto that subspace. And therefore, you have this equation at the beginning of the problem 2.5, where when you want to know what is the Haar average of phi tensor 2, is the same result as before, but you project it to the subspace HR. And the dimension, therefore, is not D, but it's the dimension of dr. Is this the question you asked me? Yeah, okay. So instead of having, so when when the space is the full space, the projection to the full space is the identity, right? Over the dimension of the space. But now it's a subspace, so you have another project which is not the identity. So it's basically the same result.
Oh, okay, thank you.
So this is a question about problem 2.5. So this means that the proof that I showed you, or that I sketched out to show how to compute this distance, can be repeated by adding a projector there. And, you know, so that there are a couple of more deltas to plug in, basically, when you put that project.
Your turn, Dario.
Dario?
I'm actually fine. I thought about it for a little bit longer. It's okay.
Great. Anyone else? Okay, so I think maybe we're done. And thank you for attending this course. It was a pleasure to teach you. I hope you enjoyed this venture in quantum information applied to fundamental problems of quantum physics. And as you can see, there are many very fundamental things in quantum mechanics that, assuming that quantum mechanics is right, we still don't know what it is. So that's why it's very exciting. Okay, so thank you again and good luck.